And it's Steve Tasker who has been all over the field.
Kind of unique. He was kind of a dual role player for you.
Steve.
A balloon.
Steve. A blimp. We're not even in the stratosphere of normalcy. All right. We are rocking on a Friday.
Friday.
Woo! Summertime.
We're ready to hit the weekend. It is a balmy day by Buffalo standards. As I'm just going to say it, we deserve it. We have soldiered through a winter and a god-awful spring, and we finally have some nice weather here, and we're going to be soaking it up big time through the course of the weekend. So we're looking forward to that. I'm sure all of you listening in the listening area that are listening in Buffalo or Rochester, for that matter, I think it's pretty similar weather for them as well. So get out, enjoy it, soak it all up, because you know it doesn't last long. but welcome to One Bills Live. Chris Brown, Steve Tasker with you here on a Friday, as Steve pointed out. And there is some more, you know, encouraging news with respect to responding and, you know, choosing love, as has been the theme this week in the wake of the tragic shootings on the East Side. NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell, who was here in town yesterday with Bruce Smith, Thurman Thomas, Jim Kelly, some other Bills legends, as well as Terry and Kim Pegula. As we know, he is a Jamestown, New York native. He and his wife, Jane, are donating $50,000 to the Bills' Social Justice Fund. That, according to a report from our broadcast partner, WIVB TV Channel 4, here in Buffalo. And we will also have, about 25, 30 minutes, we will have Steve's former teammate, Hall of Famer Bruce Smith, joining us here on the show to give us his reflections on yesterday, which for a good portion of the time had him pretty torn up. I know you, Steve, attended a church service last night, along with an address by Al Sharpton, civil rights activist, here in the city last night. So we'll be asking him about that as well. As Bruce spoke very eloquently yesterday at the scene, right. And then I know he spoke again last night, right?
Last night is one of a number of speakers last night at the Antioch Baptist Church on Fillmore there in the east, on the east side. It was a really inspiring service, and my wife Sarah and I, we were there. We were absolutely, it was a gift to us. Really important. The families were acknowledged. The tragedy of acknowledged, the evil that perpetrated this racist act was called what it was. So it was something that I and my wife really were happy and encouraged to hear all the speakers, and what a community. And when, you know, it was pointed out last night that, you know, Buffalo is a little bit different than every place else. Something like this happened in our city. We as a group, as a community, we've seen it happen in other cities. Somebody will light something on fire. Somebody will turn over a car, break the windows of the establishment, just tear things up in our anger, in our justifiable anger at what happened and what had been done to our community. There was none of that. There was no turning over cars or lighting stuff on fire, or breaking up the neighborhood. Certainly people were angry. But, you know, this is a community that chose, you know, it's the community of good neighbors, city of good neighbors. We chose to love each other and help each other through it rather than react and out and lash out like that. And it does speak to the heart of our community. And it was pointed out last night, like, certainly, every city has its issues, absolutely. But Buffalo, this has been one of the multitude of occasions where Buffalo reacted maybe differently than some other communities would have. And it's something that we can take pride in and comfort in. So very nice service last night. I want to thank all the speakers. It was very poignant, heartfelt, and well communicated on every side. So it was a gift for my wife and I to be there in attendance.
So we look forward to hearing from Bruce on that and getting his reflections on yesterday afternoon, as well as the service and the address made by a number of speakers, including Bruce himself last night. Catch up with him in about 25 minutes. As we know, Steve, This offseason, Von Miller signed a giant six-year, $120 million contract with the Bills. And now he is selling his Colorado home, where he has played most of his career, as you know. I want to see if I can interest you in the home, Steve, okay? 17,000 square feet. So you need to stretch out. You can do that. 9 bedrooms, 11 bathrooms, a movie theater, a basketball court, and are you ready for this? A cigar lounge.
Oh. Mm. Can I go online and look at it?
Oh, I'm sure you can. Here's the crazy thing. 2012, he bought this home for $925,000.
17,000 square feet for 925 grand?
A lot of space
in 2000 what?
2012. Now selling for $4.152 million. A potential gain of 345% if he gets asking price. Not a bad investment at all. There it is. Look at that. A sprawling ranch. 17,000 square feet.
On what kind of, what has he got, 5 acres there?
I told you there's a lot of land out there in Colorado.
Bro, I'm from there. I grew up across the border in Kansas. I mean, I know.
I remember.
I spent a ton of time in Denver and Gunnison and Keystone, all those places.
You're going to laugh at this. So it's about 15 years ago, as we're taking a look at some of the interior photos of Von Miller's home, our MSG viewers are getting a load of this. There's the theater room. Anyway.
Von kicking it.
Yeah. Not bad.
I should trade him straight across.
He might take it. Look at the basketball court. About 10 years ago, I'm doing a story for BuffaloBills.com just on the scouting department. And I'm talking to one of the Western scouts at the time, Brad Forsyth.
Yeah.
And Brad, I'm trying to capture, you know, how much travel these guys have to endure in the fall when they're going campus to campus.
Right.
And he's a West Scout. He's a Western region scout where the schools are much further apart from one another than they are east of the Mississippi. I said, so
most of the guys have homes that out west. They live out there.
Yes, I know. But they're still, there are times they're driving 8-10 hours a day just to get to the next campus for the next day.
I'm familiar with that.
I said, can you just paint a picture for me on what these drives are like? And he just kind of smiles and he looks at me and he says, I'm just going to put it to you this way. All these people that think our world has an overpopulation problem, he goes, please trust me.
There's lots of
space. There's plenty of space out there. What do you mean? He said, there would be times I'd be driving, you know, from Colorado to Wyoming.
Oh, yeah.
He goes,
I know.
And I don't see a building for 6 hours.
Yeah. Bro, I lived out there.
Yeah.
It's there. This is the truth. You leave Kansas City, Missouri, going west and travel across the state I grew up in, the great state of Kansas, ad astra, to the stars through difficulties is what that means.
Oh, okay.
The great state of Kansas. Head west towards Denver. The next big city you hit is Denver.
Yeah.
If you're driving one of the new cars that are like
the autonomous drivers?
Not even autonomous, just one of the new electric cars, like the Tesla that has lane control, lane correctness.
You just leave it on?
Dude, it's 10 hours of nothing.
Yeah.
You'll go through on I-70. You head west on I-70, bro sleeve.
Put it on cruise control and just kick back.
If you have that autonomous car, that's a, you know, you could
take a nap.
Oh, you could knit a sweater. You could knit a sweater.
Yeah.
It is so far. And you won't. And listen, aside from sunset and sun up, which you'll see one or the other, or both, which is spectacularly beautiful.
Well, right.
Because it's horizon.
It's horizon to horizon,
right. It's beautiful. But other than that, I mean, you're not going to miss much. I mean, it's long. It's wide and flat. It's like God took the earth, shook it out like a sheet, and spread it tight and tucked in the corners. It is flat. you could pop a quarter off that thing.
Yeah, I believe it.
I grew up out there.
Yeah, I've only seen a small piece of it, but I believe you.
Where I grew up, even now, there are people, you drive an hour for groceries.
Yeah.
Groceries.
Better have the tank full.
We had the closest high school rivalry we had was 24 miles away. And it was like you could, you know, if it wasn't for you could see it on the horizon. I mean, it was that, you know.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Good visibility day.
The homestead that is still in the family, my wife's family, there's one blinking light in our town, Leota, Kansas. It used to be red light. Now it's just a blinking light.
Mm.
5 miles. Progress. 5 miles on, straight, everything's laid out east, west, north, south. 5 miles north to the end of the Notestein airstrip where the spray pilot lives. Go to the far end of his airstrip, take a left, and go west 2 miles. 5 miles north, 2 miles west, and that's the homestead. You can see it. When you pull out of town, north, all the trees out there are planted by humans. So if you get around the trees, you pull out of town, there's no trees between you and the homestead. So at the north end of town, which is, you know, 4.5 miles from the – you can see on, you know, the built – the you know, the barn, the round top, the house – the outbuildings of the homestead. That and every other one that's dotted on the horizon, too.
Sure.
And believe me, you know who they are.
You just used a phrase that I have never heard before. Spray pilot. That's the crop dusting
crop
pilot.
Dusting guys, yeah.
Okay. That's another thing we don't do here in this part of the country. It's like, oh, yeah, it's over by the spray pilot. The who?
Down at the far end of that. Well, there's an, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's got his own private airstrip.
It's different.
Take it up. Yeah.
It's different.
Nice business. Yeah, it's different. It's different.
So, yeah, we'll see. I
you know, scouts,
it's a seller's market right now.
Yeah, right? I actually could talk to Vaughn.
Yeah, it's a seller's market.
Straight across bro sleeve.
Yeah. Could be a nice vacation home for your family, you know, that still
lives
out
that
way.
Listen, if I make that trade, it's like, I'll shake your hand and say, Brownie's been great. I'm
out. Oh, all right. Well, maybe don't talk to Vaughn.
But, out there, it's, people think Colorado is the mountains. And you saw by the picture of the house there, he's out on the outside the Front Range, out towards like the airport kind of part of the state. The airport in Denver, for those of you who haven't been there, is about 20 miles from Denver.
It's in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah, it's in western Kansas, seems like. And it looks like it's in western Kansas. It is. There's nothing there, let alone rain.
I landed there one time at nighttime in the dark.
Right.
Because I was getting in late. I was doing a UB football game, and the Bills were playing Denver the next. So I got in late.
Yeah.
I'm just like, is there anything out here?
Yeah, there is.
Because there aren't even any lights.
Yeah,
like,
the answer is no.
Yeah.
There is nothing out there.
I took a cab. I was like, oh, my gosh, this is a hike.
Denver,
to
you can see Denver. You can kind of you can see the mountains from where you're at. It's no question.
Denver, yes.
Even Denver is at the edge of the Front Range. It's in front of the Front Range of Rockies. And north of Denver's Boulder. North of that's Longmont. And then south of that is Colorado Springs, and Castle Rock is between Colorado Springs and Denver. The whole Front Range is gorgeous. But then you get up into the mountains. But the eastern third, maybe a little even more than a third of Colorado, is like western Kansas. It's plains. There's nothing there. It's as flat as you can possibly get. And the closer you get to the mountains, the more of a desert it becomes.
Yeah.
So it's a spectacularly beautiful landscape in that area for what it is, but man, oh man, you saw Vaughn's house is out in the, like, it's away
from
the mountains.
Plenty of flat land.
It's away from the mountains, yeah.
On a much more serious subject, as the NFL moves towards completing their investigation into Deshaun Watson and deciding just how long they may choose to suspend the Browns quarterback, several of the women who have accused Watson of sexual misconduct have been interviewed by HBO Real Sports with Brian Gumbel. Soledad O'Brien, a veteran news reporter, is the reporter on the story. According to a press release from HBO, the women detail the alleged abuse they suffered and share their reactions to Watson's $230 million contract with the Browns. The show is going to debut next Tuesday, May 24th at 10 p.m. So here's the NFL trying to conduct this investigation, get it wrapped up, hand down a suspension. I can't imagine they wanted this to be airing prior to their decision.
I get it.
It's a tough spot.
Let's face it here. And as big and as important as the NFL is to you and me and people in this building, it's beside the point. You got this thing going on where it was something. And for me personally, where there's smoke, there's fire. I don't believe 22 of these women are lying at all. I think he's guilty, in my personal opinion. I don't know him. I don't all that. So it really doesn't matter what the NFL does this. I want to know what happens to those to them, to the 22. I want to know how they're can. Is there any way to make it right? I don't know, but I think for the NFL, just stand back and if not wash your hands of all of this, you need to make a statement about how important this kind of thing is. And I know the guy's a good football player. Nobody outside Cleveland cares right now.
No.
You know, and even there's a lot of people inside Cleveland that don't care. So I wish the legal process would hurry up so that the 22 can get on with their lives. That's what I want. I know this is HBO's looking for viewers and eyeballs to come to their network. I get it and all that, but they don't have to convince me. I mean, the fact that there's so many of them, and that's it. And yeah, we'll see. I'm just waiting to see. That's it. That's where I'm at. What's going to happen?
Yeah.
And
we're all waiting for the other shoe to drop here.
And it should. And in my opinion, what are they waiting on? It should have dropped about 8 months ago. I mean, there's no reason for them to take this long.
Right. Lighter subject. This was a headline that grabbed my eyeballs. Tom Brady once ghosted Ryan Fitzpatrick after a loss, leading to the journeyman quarterback's favorite NFL moment. So Fitz appeared on a recent episode of ESPN's America's Caddy. Michael Collins, who's on ESPN, often on their golf coverage, and now is doing like an alternative broadcast of the PGA Tour Championship with Joe Buck. He had Fitz on, and he asked him for the best moment of his 17-year career with 9 different teams. And Fitz says, beating Tom Brady after the first time, because after the first time, he didn't shake my hand after the game. I was on the Jets so this was the 2011 win here in Buffalo. Mm. Bills beat the Patriots on a last-second field goal by Ryan Lindell at the end of the game. They win 24-21 in week 3. Didn't shake his hand after the game. So he beats Brady a second time when he's with the Jets 4 years later. He said he had to chase him down on the 50-yard line. I mean, we all know Tom Brady hates losing, Steve.
Right.
But Fitz says, when he does lose, I want a handshake.
Right? Chase him down. Rub it in his face.
Oh, my God. I love it. Don't you love Fitz even more?
Tom, I'm sorry you suck today.
Yeah.
Good luck next week.
So
thanks, bro.
Michael Collins asked him on the show, how did you make sure you shook his hand, and what did you say? He said, oh, I ran right up to him. I said, good game, Tom. Stay healthy. He just walked away.
Yeah.
Oh, boy. Gotta love Fitzy. It never gets old.
Right.
It never gets old.
He may be, Yeah. One of the all-time great guys. Every team, you know. There was a thing. Where was it? Where did I see it? Was it at the draft? I think it was. 7 or 8 guys dressed up in different uniforms. They all had Fitz jerseys.
Yes,
on.
From every different team.
It was like 8
for.
Of them.
Nine
of them. Nine different.
It was phenomenal.
9 different Ryan Fitzpatrick jerseys.
I was really impressed with the original Cincinnati jersey because that was the team that made him a 7th-round draft choice.
Right.
Then he came here, and then he bounced all around the league. Houston, Tennessee, Miami.
Washington.
You know, the Jets, the whole thing. Unbelievable.
Tampa Bay.
Really cool.
Awesome.
So that was – I just had to mention that today. That was worth mentioning. And then in the latest edition of As the World Turns in New England with the New England Patriots, even their analysts that cover the team are pressing the panic button, Steve. Boston Sports Journal editor Greg Bedard, in an appearance on the New England Sports Network, said the Patriots' offensive plans by what could be a co-coordinator situation between Joe Judge and Matt Patricia is already setting off alarm bells for the players. They're just getting started. with OTAs this week, somebody's sounding an alarm bell, and I believe we have Greg Bedard commenting on this. So here is Boston Sports Journal editor Greg Bedard commenting on the state of affairs at One Patriot Place.
I don't want to make a huge deal out of this yet, because let's keep in mind, this is a completely new regime on the offensive side of the ball. They could be doing things a different way, and there could be a lot of people who aren't used to the new way things are going to be done, and maybe they might be better. I'm allowing for that, because it's extremely early in terms of what they've done. But so far, I mean, I have countless people who have either been with the Patriots or are hearing from players on the team who they are alarmed to this point, and they've barely done anything so far, Trenny. And so they are really worried about the direction of the offense, where this is going, especially off of what a lot of people heard. A lot of people around the NFL listened to what Joe Judge said the other day, and almost all of them were like, what? What is he talking about? And so there is a high level of concern about what's going on with the Patriots.
High level of concern. Now, look, we're in May. They're just getting started. But, oh, my God, get me a soup ladle. I can't lap this up fast enough. Get me a soup ladle and just start shoveling it into my mouth. I can't get enough of this. Yeah. This is fantastic. I said it last week, Steve. The New England Patriots, as they are currently constituted, are going to be in last place in this division. The Jets are going to surprise some people this year. They're going to win 7 or 8 games. Patriots are going to be 6-11. And sitting in last place.
I don't know.
And
we're
all going to party like it's 1999 and love it.
I can't see the Patriots dropping that far. Certainly at this point, and this could all be bunk.
You think it's a ruse?
It could be a ruse.
An elaborate plan of Bill Belichick's.
An elaborate plot to lull us into a false sense of security. I don't know. Certainly.
All I'm going to say is this, Steve. How did the co-coordinators go in Miami last year?
I'm with you on that.
How did that work?
I would say, here's the thing. I think that's all mystery. I don't think there's any question there's only going to be one voice in that room when they get closer to training camp and it's going to start to come out. They're going to have one guy doing it. It's probably going to be Joe Judge.
Woof, then.
And I'll say this. It is going to be painful for the Patriots because Josh McDaniel has been doing that for a long, long time, and it has been one way. And then they lost the quarterback who really was as much of an offensive coordinator as anybody else was, and Josh McDaniel's taken over and kind of doing that. So you've got two massive forces in that offense that have exited over the past 2.5 years, and now you've got to replace those guys with other coaches.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be hard to do. It's going to be hard to get done without any pain at all, without any growing pains at all. So there's going to be some of that going on, and particularly for some players, if any. I don't even know I couldn't tell you the roster. But for guys who have been there a long time and to have new guys doing it, different ways of looking at it, different philosophies, and it could be different schedules, different meeting patterns, whatever it is, different ways of communicating, it's going to be very vastly different than it's been for a decade. So there is going to be some growing pains, and I'm sure that there are guys around who see it from the outside, who have been inside, who are now outside and see it doing, they're going, wow. You know, it just doesn't register for them. So
yeah.
I'm not gonna overreact to this. The Patriots are going to be a competitive football team. I don't know if they're going to go 6-10, but certainly they've done a number of things this offseason that remind us that they've always done things differently. And they've been pretty successful doing it. So I'm not going to write them off, not to the extent you are.
So different, in fact, that their first-round draft choice, Cole Strange, revealed in an interview that when he got a call and they said, hi, this is so-and-so from the Patriots, he asked, is this a prank call? So apparently even Cole Strange thinks he was a reach.
Well,
that's
he knew.
That's a first round.
Well,
draft
that's the thing. When you're going to get drafted, when you're a first, second, third round draft pick, a day one or a day two pick, you know you're going to get drafted at some point.
Oh.
But you also get an idea of the level that what people think about. You cross reference what this team says to you in comparison to what the other team says to you, and that this team says to you, and what these two teams say to you in comparison to what these other two teams say to you. Because when you're that high, 32 teams have a shot at you, and all 32 would probably be interested in you in drafting you if you fall far enough. So he's sitting there cross-referencing everything that's been said to him and thinking, okay, I've got a chance to be a late day two pick, something like that. So to get called halfway through the first, he's going to be thinking, are you kidding? Who is this? Yeah. Right? Yeah. He knew.
Unbelievable.
Particularly because you know how the Patriots do it. They might not even have spoken to the kid. They probably talked to him and said, well, you know, we don't know. They wouldn't tell him.
There is an NFL draft advisory council that if an agent for a player asks, they will give them their approximate value on a draft board across the league, like an average value of where teams see them. And if they're a first, second round pick, third round pick, et cetera. So you had to have some idea, which is why he probably had the reaction that he did.
Right.
Because that was not the grade that he clearly got from the advisory council. All right, we got to take a break here because when we come back, we'll be joined by Bills Hall of Famer Bruce Smith, going to give us his reflections on his visit down to the East Side yesterday at the site of the tragic shooting, as well as last night's service and presentation that Steve attended last night in Buffalo as well. All of that coming up next with Bills Hall of Famer Bruce Smith next year on One Bills Live, presented by Kalata Health. It's Buffalo Bills Radio. All right, welcome back to One Bills Live. Chris Brown, Steve Tasker with you, and joined by Bills Hall of Famer Bruce Smith, who's been in town the last couple of days. Obviously, everyone saw his visit over the East Side with his good friends Thurman Thomas and Jim Kelly, along with the Pegulas, and NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell. Why don't we first reflect on that, Bruce? It was very obvious to all of the people that were watching as we were covering it here on the show. We had video footage of your visit over there and, you know, you're doing a Q&A with the media as well. But people always say you can always see and the coverage of a tragedy like this, but when you are on site, the weight of it hits you fully. So how long did that take? You show up on the scene. How long did – probably took about 10 seconds for the weight of it to hit you, right?
If that long. First of all, to have Roger Goodell come in town, I'd spoke with him a number of times and said that we need to go to Buffalo. The Pegulas called me and extended to I was already coming down, and they found out that I was coming down, and they came and picked me up. And we all rode to Buffalo together and attended these services and went to visit the memorial site and the actual site of the scene of the crime together. And as I walked out to the memorial site, it hit me.
Yeah.
And I cried like a baby.
Yeah.
There were no words that could express the array of emotions that I felt for this community, for the city of Buffalo. And but that's all a part of the healing process.
Right.
But until you actually physically are present at the memorial to see what actually took place, not on TV, yeah, but your physical presence, and see the 10 names that had crosses laid in the grass at the scene of this massacre, you just can't comprehend it until you're actually there.
Yeah.
So
yeah, it does make a difference. I mean, I told you, Sarah and I drove there last night after the service, which was just down the street, and there were people there. Still, it was late, and you get a sense of the space and the, you know, the prominence of the building and that area right there. We've heard also that, you know, that supermarket, that Tops there, was really important to that community.
It's an anchor point.
Really important to that community. And to choose that as a target, it was, there's just so many things that hit you about the every level of disgust and anger and all the wrong that is about what happened. It hits you all at once, and it's hard. It's really, I think, and I would encourage people to visit and stop. You can't miss it. There's flowers laying, literally, at 20 different spots where people have paid their respects, and it's very moving, very
pure,
moving.
Pure evil.
Yeah,
evil like I've never experienced before in my lifetime. You know, it's one thing when you see shootings like this in another state that's far away from you. Mm-hmm. It does not impact you the way it impacts you when it happens in your house, in your front yard, mm-hmm. to people whom you love dearly, defenseless people. And it brings to mind, and it brings to question, how many more times do innocent people of color have to suffer these atrocities that take place? And it seems like it's on a routine basis.
Well, there was another, Bruce, I don't have to tell you this, there was another shooting the same day in California at a Presbyterian church that targeted Taiwanese people.
Yes.
And so, yes, believe me, I'm not going to debate this for a second. The black community has shouldered more of this than any other race, and I don't even think it's close in this country. And that's bad enough. And now we have, the Asian community has been a target since the pandemic hit because they're unfairly blamed for the COVID pandemic. And it's continuing. It doesn't matter what ethnic group is targeted. It's all wrong. And the thing that bothers me the most is everything today gets politicized. This is not a political issue. This is about being a better human being. At its very core level, very base level, just be better human beings. I don't care what political affiliation you have. Just be a better human.
Yeah, I'll say one of the things that jumped out at me last night as I was sitting there and listening to the speakers. One of the problems has always been for events like this, and I say events like this, and sadly, there's too many to count. People who look like me are silent in the aftermath. There's no outrage. There's just quiet. And in that silence, it is interpreted sometimes as complicity. And that's, you can't be silent. You have to, and I say it to somebody, if you look like me, go out and say it to somebody how wrong it is. Mm. Find somebody and tell them you believe and know in your heart that it is wrong. Otherwise, you're complicit. You've got to make it public of how wrong it is that you're against things like that, that you don't believe the cockamamie rhetoric that surrounds acts of violence like this, racial acts of violence like this. You cannot stay silent. You have to speak up, particularly people who look like Brownie and I.
Right, because when it comes from the Caucasian community, and you can agree or disagree, Bruce, I think it carries more weight, does it not? When it comes from our community to support yours, it carries more weight sometimes.
The unification.
Yes.
The unification is stronger when there's both sides of the equation that comes to the table and makes these comments about racism. I had the opportunity, I was invited to the Antioch
tell
Baptist
us more about
Church,
that last night.
And I invited some of my teammates, and Steve was, as Steve always does, I'll be there.
Yep.
And if you could have seen the reception that the people gave him when I announced his presence, you see, because I know Steve's heart, and I know his thinking and how he's compassionate, and he cares about the human race. So to have he and Sarah there, supporting the community spoke volumes. I also had a few other friends that were there, Jeremy from the Bills and JT, used to be a state trooper, and his daughter. But I saw so many people that I knew from my playing days, and we were able to interact. And just for a moment, they put a smile on their face.
Yeah.
It took their minds off of this horrific event that took down. And one of the things that has made me so proud has been this community.
Yeah.
Coming together. Not taking a position of retaliatorial measures, but one in which we were smart enough to identify what this person was trying to do. He was trying to divide us. He wants the African American population or the community to live in fear. And as a matter of fact, when I went down to Tops yesterday, I heard stories of some of the kids that live in the neighborhoods afraid to come out, afraid to be in groups because they felt they would be easy targets after this horrific event. And while it's going to take some time and the parents are going to have to do a miraculous job of just showing these kids love and obviously our leaders are going to have to make sure these neighborhoods are protected. But we cannot allow racist individuals who are, and I don't even want to say they're sick, but their minds to go and strike down, kill 10 people, pillars within our communities, mm-hmm. A grandmother, a caregiver to her husband, a security guard who was a former lieutenant with the Buffalo Police,
a dad. A 3-year-old trying to go get his birthday cake.
A dad. I mean, it's just heartbreaking. Defenseless, innocent people who weren't harming anyone. Mm-hmm. And as this time progresses, we're going to learn more and more about this individual that perpetrated this act. And there's going to have to be some accountability, and there's going to have to be some justice. I was just informed that he shot 54 rounds in 5 minutes. Right. 54 rounds.
Right.
Aaron Salter, had it not been for his bravery and his heroism, I would argue that they would have been, it would have been much worse.
Right.
He got all 10 rounds, but the perpetrator had on a metal
body armor.
Yeah.
So it did not penetrate his body armor. So that begs the question, why do we have folks in military gear or selling folks body armor?
Why do you have assault rifles?
And things of that nature. Well, it was, from my understanding, it was a rifle that was converted into an assault rifle.
Yeah.
And there's more information that will be coming out.
And none of it's going to be pretty.
Yeah.
None of it's going to be acceptable. None of it should be. I got to tell you, Bruce, and, you know, as we sit here and talk, it means a lot to the community that you're back. Obviously, you know your place in our community and our hearts and the people here in Buffalo. Everybody's familiar with you and your name and your great career and your Hall of Fame stature and I know you as a personal friend and, you know, and the journey you've been on for your entire life and how awesome it's been. Thank you so much for coming back home and helping all of us through this. And I just want to ask you, you're going to stay for a day or two longer. What are you going to do today? What are your plans today? What's going on?
Well, first and foremost, I love Buffalo. I love the people of Buffalo. Their resilience, their strength, in the community, in the African-American community. They are faithful Christians. They love one another. They will do anything in the world for one another. And now we're going to have to rise to the occasion and support this community the way it loves Buffalo. But I love the people of Buffalo. It brightens. It just makes me feel so good when I'm in town. And I feel the love, and I could see it in people's eyes, and take the football part out of it. But just the humanity part is what makes me feel so good. Today I just came from seeing the sheriff of Buffalo, John, where he deputized me. So now you guys have to
that's pretty awesome.
Call me Deputy that Smith.
You talk about full circle, bro.
Yeah, wow. I got a couple. Hey, leave it up to Steve. Yeah, I got a couple fitting. Of citations I'm going to pass out here.
Okay.
That's great. Can't wait for that.
Yeah, put one on my car and window outside. It's like old times, right?
Yeah. I'm going to go out to the there's a event that's taking place. Where they're going to be serving some food out at one of the parks in downtown Buffalo. So I'm going to go out there and spend some time and continue to get in the community and have conversations and hug people and just let them know I love them.
Yeah. Well, I know Bruce, your support was unquestionably appreciated by the Buffalo community, and it unquestionably made a difference yesterday, today, et cetera. So as Steve said, we appreciate you coming back. I know your support was genuinely appreciated by everybody here in Western New York. So it's good to see you.
Yeah.
We look forward to seeing you back here again. And I know if there are efforts going forward to make a lasting impact, which I think is the goal here, because yeah. 2 weeks from now, we don't want people to forget about what happened over there. I know you'll be a part of that. So good to see you, Bruce, and thanks again.
Well, thanks, Chris. And you brought up a great point. The families feel the love and the support right now,
mm-hmm.
but a month from now, 6 months from now,
right.
we still need to be there for them.
100%.
That's the critical piece that we cannot let slip through the cracks.
Yeah. Right. That's Bills Hall of Famer Bruce Smith joining us here on One Bills Live. We will take a break, be back with more. We'll see you in a few minutes. Back here on One Bills Live, Chris Brown, Steve Tasker with you. Going to go to the phones here now to a good friend of the show. We go to Butch on the East Side. What do you have for us, Butch? You're on One Bills Live.
But first of all, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Steve and Chris, you guys know I've been talking to you for years. And you know the first thing I'm going to tell you guys is that I love you. Now, I'm saying that sincerely. As one of the volunteer coordinators here at 347 East Ferry Street, working with the Veterans Volunteer Service Association, along with other volunteer groups. I'm going to start you on Wednesday. Wednesday, we had a little traffic control. I saw 4 state trooper cars, and I saw 3 tour buses coming and 4 state troopers after them. When I got close and I was waving them in, I saw the players on the bus, and I didn't know it was the players. But they were heading to the site. I really appreciate them. The people in the community really appreciate them. The love that was shown from that side of the fence, fires on the entertainment, athletic side of the fence, the community absorbed that. When they went on Jefferson Avenue and just spread out walking around, like Steve said, he went to the site. He's been up there when they opened the street of Jefferson to drive by. The people out there just loved it. That's Wednesday. Thursday came, and the site was so beautiful. No one expected Mr. Pegula, Mr. Goodell, Mr. Smith, Mr. Kelly, Mr. Thomas, et cetera, et cetera. The one that blew us away was when Mr. Jenneret walked up in there, and that was exciting. You know, it was the love, the love, the love, the love. And I just want to say thank you to you guys. That just not just at One Bills Drive, down at the Sabres organization. Yep. I want to say thank you to the corporations out there that's sending food and sending money to the east side of Buffalo. Once upon a time, they used to call us a lost city on the east side. Now people are that's going in there seeing good inside, regardless of what the bad furnace did. Now, I'm going to put that on the side of the saying all my thank yous, and then I'm going to close on this. I do not hate this young man. I hate the furnace that it comes from. Right now, this young man came as a young man, but the furnace inside brought up bad heat, and he made a terrible decision. The same furnace, Steve and Chris, is some of the same furnace right now at the Supreme Court where they're threatening about abortion, that they said they were going to come in and kill the Supreme Court people, and they had to put a fence around the Supreme Court. That's the furnace. That's the furnace this young man got ideas from. This is where we have to attack that. And it's not about the color, about the race. That's just excuses. It's about the furnace of love and hate. And this is why sometimes, you know, you guys laugh at me a lot when I say, I love you, Steve. I love you, Chris. And I mean that sincerely. And Chris, you don't for years. And Steve, you know, for years I've been calling. I've always said that. I always said WGR 55 was my team. And I mean it. I love WGR. But I want to say to the people out there, we on the east side of Buffalo, and I'm going to be one of the advocates to say it, that we love each and every one of you. We love your time. We love your volunteerism. We love your prayers. We love the sincereness. We love everything about you. And moving forward on the east side of Buffalo, I want everyone out there to adopt the east side of Buffalo. Come in and put some businesses, some mom-and-pop shops to make some money over there. But guess what? You're going to be creating jobs for other people. Come on over there and hang out with us a little bit. And I love you guys, man. And I don't really want to talk football. I just want to just say that to you guys. And I've been wanting to call you when this first happened, but I'm just trying to get it together. But Bruce, like Bruce said, I'm closing on this. You have to actually walk over there to that site. And when you hit that site, Steve knows, when you hit that site, it's something that's going to hit you. It's like a wall, and you're going to see the spiritualism of it on that. But I love you guys. Thanks so much for taking my call. And again, to everybody in Western New York or anybody around the world who watches this show, we on the east side of Buffalo love you. We want to say thank you so much. And the veterans, Volunteer Veteran Service Association, definitely love you, along with the other volunteer organizations. Thank you so much, guys, for taking my call.
All right. Thanks, Butch. We love you, too. We're all trying to do what we can to support the east side. As Steve mentioned, he was down there last night, went to the church service at the Baptist Antioch Baptist Church. He was there with Bruce. The Reverend Sharpton spoke as well. You witnessed the healing firsthand.
Yeah. First of all, Bruce, thanks for calling. We appreciate you. And, you know, I told this, I don't know who I was telling this story to. Actually, I think I was at an event over during this week, and I said it to some people that, you know, my wife and I got moved here overnight out of the blue. Didn't know Buffalo, couldn't have found it on a map, and have been here for 35 plus years now, and it's home. And the reason we have loved it here since the very beginning of when we got here is because of the people here. The way they feel about each other and about the place they live, this city, the people in it, everybody in it, and it, you know, it's real. It's real. That's why, you know, this evil had to come in from outside, in my opinion, because the people here we don't do that to each other. Like I said earlier in the show, when this happened to our community, you didn't get riots and fires and cars turned over and windows broken and buildings burned down. You got an outpouring of love. That makes this city a little different than every place else. Mm-hmm. And it's real. Bruce, see, you can feel it when you go to Jefferson Street tops. You can feel it. When you see prominent members and prominent figures in this community go down there and be moved by it emotionally and lay flowers, and it's different here. And, you know, we knew it before something like this had to show it and prove it. Maybe more people will see it now, and maybe the way we handle this together, everybody in the community will be something that other communities can look at, other people can look at, and maybe the like Butch said, this whatever furnace or factory creates this hatred and this evil will be shut down or hamstrung by the fact that it
or eliminated.
Yeah, or eliminated because it didn't put a dent in this community.
No.
Hopefully that happens. But I'm with you, Butch. Thank you for your call. We love you too, and we appreciate you listening and everybody else. Thank you.
Yeah. Well said, Steve. We will change gears as we take a break here, because when we come back, we will be joined by Pro Football Focus lead NFL analyst Sam Monson, who had grades for all 32 NFL off seasons. We'll find out where the Bills wound up in his grading scale next. Here on One Bills Live, presented by Kalata Health, it's Buffalo Bills Radio.
Tasker, who has been all over the field.
Kind of unique. He was kind of a dual-role player for you.
Steve.
A balloon.
Steve. A blimp. We're not even in the stratosphere of normalcy. All right, hour number two here on a Friday. Chris Brown, Steve Tasker, One Bills Live is the show. Pleased to be joined now by Pro Football Focus lead NFL analyst Sam Monson, who is already neck-deep in off-season analysis and recently put out his grades for how each of the 32 NFL teams fared through the course of at least the majority of the roster adjusting with the draft and most of free agency now in the rearview mirror. Sam, thank you. Thanks for joining us, first of all. And second, where did the Bills shake out here in your list of NFL offseason grades?
Yeah, I think the Bills had one of the better off seasons in the NFL. I think I gave them a B+ overall for their entire off season. The top teams out there were getting A grades, so they were a tiny touch below that. But the Bills are now in this tough spot where, like, the roster is so good, it's hard to make massive leaps forward. Like, there isn't room to go that much better. And even with moves like signing Von Miller and kind of getting involved in this AFC arms race, it's tough to have as good an offseason as some of these teams that were able to, you know, fundamentally change their outlook heading into 2022.
And you see the Bills, their philosophy has been to refurbish. They get a lot of guys every year on one-year deals. Those guys come in for a good buck, no question, but they're motivated to play hard, and the Bills get a really good contribution for them. But because of that, there is some roster turnover year to year with some pretty significant contributors sometimes out of the mix. John Feliciano, who was there for a couple of years, didn't finish the season with the Bills, but he was on the bench. He's gone. Other guys like that have happened. Quentin Spain did the same thing a couple of years ago. The Bills seem to switch out big men at a higher rate than most teams do. Now, certainly they replace them with some guys that are the same thing. They come in and contribute. What are your thoughts on how much do you dock or knock off or maybe build up a team because of rosters like that? They're going to get pretty good guys in, but they let some pretty good guys go.
Yeah, I think the Bills have had quite a smart approach to their offensive line since this regime came in. You know, they've attacked it with volume. They've attacked it with a lot of guys that should be able to come in and almost platoon a group to be at a certain level. And really, we've been preaching for years at PFF that you don't need a great offensive line. You know, it's nice. No one's going to turn down the best offensive line in the NFL, but they don't come cheap. So instead of paying a giant amount of money for five all pros on the offensive line, one or two of which may get hurt in any given year, let's share the resources out more equally throughout the roster. Let's bring in a whole load of guys that will be average at least on the offensive line and make sure that there's no weak link. And if you have five average starters on the offensive line, you have a pretty good offensive line. And if you have a quarterback like Josh Allen, you know, he's more than good enough to make the difference between that pretty good offensive line and one of the league's best. And you have all that money that you saved rather than paying all those guys sort of all pro money. So they, I think, have done a really good job of maintaining depth and an awfully high baseline of play from that offensive line. And while it's not necessarily been the best in the league, it's not been a problem for them either. So I kind of like the approach they've taken generally with those big guys on either side of the line, actually.
I know PFF recently named Micah Hyde one of their most underrated players. I think we can all agree that for the better part of the McDermott era, the secondary has been the linchpin of this defense and has made it a top five unit almost year over year and up in the top five against the pass as well. I know Von Miller's only one guy, but with Von Miller added to this defense for the first time in the McDermott era, you have a primary A1 pass rushing talent. How much can he even the scales, do you think, Sam, in terms of Buffalo's pass rush on the front end being on a par or close to a level of the play that the back end has provided the last 5 years?
Yeah, well, obviously a big part of that is whether these young guys are going to develop alongside him and sort of take advantage of the attention that Von Miller is going to draw. Really, what Von Miller is an upgrade over Jerry Hughes as that primary kind of source of pressure on this defense. And he should be a pretty significant one, even though Jerry Hughes for years has been one of those most underrated players in the NFL. Jerry Hughes is probably good for 50, 55 pressures in the course of a season. Von Miller, for most of his career, was averaging like 85. So you're talking at least a couple of pressures a game extra on top of what Jerry Hughes was going to bring you. And if he gets, you know, back to his very best play, I mean, he had his first double-digit pressure game in the playoffs for the first time in a few years last season with the Rams. Like, Von Miller at his best can get you 10 pressures in the course of a game. He can take over and absolutely transform the way that game is going. But even with last season thrown in there, I think we're still working with, you know, a declining version of Von Miller, but he's declining from the point of being the best edge rusher of his generation. So he can fall an awful long way and still be a very good pass rusher.
One of the things about these roster builds is that you got to find guys who give you value for something, you know, more than the contract is worth. One of the guys you've got for the Buffalo Bills is Micah Hyde as being one of the most underrated players that the Buffalo Bills have on their roster, even around the league. Certainly the Bills have had a secondary that's been stellar with Tre'Davious White, Poyer, Hyde, and then in the years last 4 years been Levi Wallace and Taron Johnson in the secondary. Talk a little bit about Micah Hyde and the importance that he has toward that secondary. You have him as one of the most underrated players in the Bills roster.
Yeah, I think both safeties are pretty underrated as well. You have to sort of acknowledge that I think this scheme is quite safety friendly, quite defensive back friendly. Generally, they put those guys in a good position to succeed. They set them up for success. And if you're going to go back prior to the Bills, you look at those Carolina defenses before McDermott came over, you know, those safeties were grading well as well, even though they weren't necessarily as good a player as a guy like Micah Hyde or Jordan Poyer. But those guys are both versatile. They can both do anything within the secondary. They can line up, you know, deep as a free safety. They can be in the box. They can cover slot players. They can cover tight ends and running backs out of the backfield. So those are the guys, the glue pieces that allow everybody else to function within that defense. They can move around no matter what coverage shell it is you're trying to run, and they make it work. So I love the way those two guys have been playing. I think they complement each other really well as well and work potentially better as a duo than they would individually. And yeah, I don't think they really get the credit they deserve as just these two extremely consistent high-level performers year on year.
I know you recently had a piece about the Jets being the big winners from the draft. It makes a lot of sense. It also helps when all of your picks are in the first four rounds, and three of them are in round one. But unlike Jets of years past, they appear to hit on people at the proper value for the most part, at least in terms of general consensus. How realistic is it that maybe more than half of those guys are going to see a decent amount of playing time in year one as rookies. I mean, it's a roster that had its share of holds. So when you get talent like this, get it on the field sooner rather than later, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I think those three first-round picks should all be starters or effectively starters, right? Jermaine Johnson on the edge probably forms a kind of platoon with Carl Lawson coming back from his injury and John Franklin Myers there as well. So those three guys, I would imagine, will be like the primary source of edge defender pass rush for them. But Garrett Wilson, a wide receiver, Sauce Gardner, a cornerback, those two guys should be immediate starters for them and arguably the number ones at their respective position. Like they brought in DJ Reed in free agency as well. And that's part of liking what the Jets are doing is that they've been building, I think, in the right direction for a while now. None of it's going to matter unless Zach Wilson can take a big jump forward in leap two or in year two and show that he's really the quarterback of the future for that team. But it's tough to disagree with what they've been doing in terms of building around him. And yeah, look, there are people that sort of say, of course, the Jets had a great draft. They had all these high first round picks, but you got to give them credit for taking the layups, right? They were layups. They're easier shots than other shots, but you can screw it up, right? You can miss the layup. And I think the Jets got three really good players at good value at those respective picks. And, you know, you should give them credit for that. It would have been easy, particularly with the Jets in previous years, to run that right off the rails and taking a player, you know, that was a massive reach or didn't fill a position of need or something like that.
One of the things about their picks, you know, they've got two in their first four picks. They got two offensive and two defensive players. The offensive guys are skill guys, Garrett Wilson and Breece Hall. Breece Hall was number one running back in a lot of boards coming out of this draft. And, of course, Garrett Wilson might have been the number one wideout on a lot of boards, although it's a, you know, as every year, the wide receivers are a deep group. Could those, and because they depend on Zach Wilson's success, those two guys, how much can the Jets rely on them to help Zach Wilson? You know, even as first-year players, is that a too big a ask for, even for players with a high end like these two guys have?
I think what they're doing is kind of similar to what the Bills did with Josh Allen, right? Which is you surround him with as much talent as possible. You believe in him as the guy, but ultimately it then comes down to him taking that step forward. And the Jets are giving Zach Wilson every conceivable opportunity to be good. They've given him an overhauled offensive line over the course of the last couple of years. That unit finished the season, I think, ranked 11th in PFF's offensive line rankings. It probably got better in the offseason. So the line should be good. Their receiving core, they started doing this last year with Elijah Moore and with Corey Davis coming in. And maybe Davis can't be that number one receiver, but now you've got Garrett Wilson coming in to at least complement him. Maybe Garrett Wilson can't be that true number one guy either, but all of a sudden you've got two or three guys that can all get open at different areas. And then Breece Hall has that kind of skill set to be a classic throwback bell cow kind of running back and do everything for that offense. So all of a sudden you look around Zach Wilson and you say, well, everything's there. Like the coaching is there. The scheme is there. The running back is there. The offensive line, the weapons. Now it's all on you, you know, and that doesn't mean it will work, because if he doesn't have that ability in him, it's not going to manifest itself just because his supporting cast is really good. But if they believe in him, this is the way of doing it. Give him as much opportunity to be good as possible and then let him show it.
Last one for me, Sam, deals with a landing spot, if there is one, for Baker Mayfield. It doesn't look like anybody's going to touch him until the Browns up and release him, because nobody wants to take on that contract, and we all understand why. Is it as simple as saying, well, Carolina needs one, Seattle needs one, he'll end up in one of those two spots? I just wonder what's – I don't know, because Carolina's kind of a complicated situation. Do you want to have two of the top three picks from the 2018 draft that were cast offs by their original teams? You want two of those guys? Because the first one didn't work out so well in year one in Carolina. So I'm just kind of trying to crawl in the head of the two organizations to see if there really would be genuine interest in him by either club.
Yeah, Carolina's tough because you've also got to factor in that the top two guys in that organization in terms of GM and head coach are probably both, you know, on the hot seat on borrowed time as well. So they have to think about, well, what's going to give us the best chance of saving our jobs here? It's a tough sell for Carolina to essentially almost repeat the Sam Darnold experiment a year later.
Yeah.
And it becomes a dramatically different sell if you're picking up that contract for Baker Mayfield versus if he's essentially getting paid almost nothing as a free agent once they cut him. If the Panthers can convince Cleveland to eat a ton of that money before they trade him, then I think it's a potential landing spot. Similarly, Seattle, they don't seem to be dramatically interested right now. I wonder if Seattle's even that interested in winning next year as opposed to, you know, being year one of a rebuild and we go after the quarterback next year. Those, I think, are the two destinations that have any chance whatsoever of trading anything for Baker Mayfield. But if the Browns end up releasing him, and let's bear in mind, we don't know if Deshaun Watson's getting suspended yet. So the Browns might need Baker Mayfield this season, which makes the whole thing even more complicated and even more messy if he stays there. But if he gets cut and all of a sudden he's available for not much money at all, I think half the league should be interested in him as a backup quarterback. And maybe, you know, that self-selects and he's only interested in somewhere where he thinks he can get a starting opportunity as well. But if he's willing to accept the role as a backup, I mean, this is a guy who on the field is probably a mid-tier quarterback, right? Somewhere in the sort of 15, 16, 17 kind of range in the NFL. So by definition, that makes him the best backup quarterback in the NFL if you could get hold of that. So if the contract stops to become an issue, I think most teams would be picking up the phone and seeing if Baker Mayfield is interested in taking a job as a backup.
Last one for me, Sam. Of the there's seven playoff teams in each conference. In the AFC, it was Tennessee, Kansas City, Buffalo, Cincinnati, Vegas, New England, Pittsburgh. Of the teams remaining, who was out of the playoffs last year that you think are absolutely going to make the playoffs this year? We see one every year. Who do you think it's going to be this year?
I think they're both in the AFC North. I think Baltimore and Cleveland, if they have a healthy Deshaun Watson all year, even if they have Baker Mayfield for a half the year, Cleveland and Baltimore are the two teams I think that have definitely playoff caliber rosters. Certainly when you look at Baltimore and you look at how injury ravaged they were last year, halfway through the season, they were the number one seed in the AFC. And then injuries just struck so hard. They were calling up guys on a Friday to cover Devontae Adams on the weekend. And obviously that's not going to go well. So the Ravens aren't going to get as injured as they were a year ago. They have a great head coach in John Harbaugh. They have a ton of talent on that roster. I think they're automatically back in the playoff hunt and maybe a contender just by not being as unlucky as they were a year ago. And then Cleveland is a similar story. They have a great roster. They had an injured quarterback basically all last season. In theory, they've upgraded on him. And even if he ends up being the guy again for half the year, he should be better than he was a year ago. So I think those two teams are definitely going to be right back in the mix.
Lead NFL analyst for Pro Football Focus, Sam Monson. Sam, thanks for joining us. Have a good weekend. We'll catch up with you down the line.
Thanks, Sam.
Anytime, guys. Thanks for having me. Take it easy.
Sam Monson joining us there and kind of breaking down some of the latest coverage on Pro Football Focus as people are already ramping up for 2022 prognostication.
Why not?
Well, what else are you doing?
What's stopping us?
What else are you doing in late May?
Right.
I don't know. And I know you're not as bullish on the Jets actually being competitive as I am. There might be some of it. I'll admit what might be baked into some of that is my desire to see the New England Patriots fall completely to the basement of the division. I could see the Jets if they can put it. There's a lot to put together there. And yes, Zach Wilson has to hit like Sam Monson indicated. But I think they could be a 7-win team, 6-7 win team.
I'm not as down on
the Patriots.
Zach Wilson are. I think the Jets are going to be a little better than people give him credit for. Because
even better than 6 or 7 wins?
Yeah. I think they can get up.
You could flirt with 5.
Seven. If you gave me the over-under of 7, I'd take the over.
You would? Okay.
Yeah. I think Salah is going to – he's going to take a step forward this year. I think that's going to help that team.
The
talent is going to help. I like what they're doing. And it's going to come down to a little bit of their culture. Certainly, it's always a self-destructive atmosphere with the Jets and the Giants because of the media press that goes on. As soon as you start doing well in New York, you know, they start trying to tear you down. So it's hard to do that in New York. But I like what the Jets have done.
And I like what they tried to do last year. And I'm not that down on Zach Wilson. I know I'm not in the building, so I don't know. If you're hearing it from inside the building, maybe it's true. I think one of the thing that I asked him there at the end about the Jets and about the teams that didn't make the playoffs in the AFC and who would, his thing, Cleveland and Baltimore, that surprises me a little bit. Because, you think about Indianapolis, Miami, the Chargers, and Denver with Russ Wilson. He didn't think any of those teams, although it's not out of the question they could. And then last year,
I would pick Denver.
New England and
Pittsburgh. I would pick Denver before I pick Cleveland, it's an unknown factor. Like, is Watson playing 4 games, 5 games, 10 games, 12 games? You don't know.
11 games, probably, right? But you think about and Indianapolis with Matt Ryan. Okay, there's a little unknown there at quarterback, but not that much unknown.
I like Indy.
I do too. The Chargers.
Chargers.
Goodness gracious, they had a splashy offseason. If that goes well for them. They're it. Plus, here's the other thing. It was Pittsburgh and New England at 6-7 in the playoffs last year. There's two teams that are not better. Yeah. I don't think.
Pittsburgh has a good defense, but yeah, there isn't much else to work with there.
Vegas is in the West now with Kansas City, and they had two teams in there last year. Now, Vegas or Kansas City could still make the playoffs, but, man, do both of them make it?
Not all four teams in the West are making it. We know
exactly.
That.
Exactly. So,
I mean, maybe three if the AFC South completely tanks and only a division winner gets in, and the AFC East tanks and only the Bills get in. Maybe that's a way.
Right. My thought behind asking Sam that was that, man, oh, man, there's a lot of teams that were meh, getting in last year. And a lot of teams that you thought were going to get in last year that didn't.
And now it's
this year. It's the same thing going into the season. You think, there's a big mush of teams from the 4 or 5 seed all the way down. You think, man, any of those teams. I don't think Cincinnati's not going to repeat, I don't think, in that division.
Yeah.
But they're still a pretty good team.
Yes. I'm trying to think.
So you can't throw them out, but they certainly are in – now wild card kind of thing rather than if you don't think they're going to be able to beat, Cleveland or Baltimore.
I'm trying to think of that long word you used yesterday that you used properly and I was impressed by at the beginning of the show. And I said, oh, that's the word of the day.
Yeah.
You followed that up here today with an expert description on how closely packed these teams are, calling it a big mush of teams.
That's right.
I mean – the sophistication
the poignant,
and the mastery of the English language that you have.
The poignant mastery of the English language.
I got to tell you, it's impressive.
It's a big mush.
It's impressive. A big mush of teams. I don't know if you could have described it any better. That was fantastic. there is one little interesting NFL note that I just happened to come across in the Sports Business Journal. In the NFL's clear desire, to take over the world, they have... did you see this? They've set to open an Australian office in Sydney. The NFL has decided to establish an office in Sydney, which is expected to open this October. 4 high-ranking NFL officials flew to Sydney last week to reveal plans about growing the giant U.S. sport internationally while targeting Australian footy players and those throughout the Pacific. So they're opening offices there. And they're going to set roots down to try to encourage kids that usually gravitate to Australian rules football to try American football.
Yeah, it's a decades long project. That is, because we all know too, it's different than if you were trying to expand the game of golf to Australia or the game of tennis to Australia, or ping pong, even basketball.
Well, right,
because you need a ton of guys interested to get that started. Yep. You can't just go out and play catch.
But that's happened in the UK. I mean, we've
certainly
got UK.
I saw it happen in Italy. I saw that. And there's a league.
You got F.A. Obata here last year.
Oh, yeah. Christian Wade.
Yep.
There's some guys over there that play. Yeah, absolutely. But it does take.
Takes time.
Takes time for a generation of players to elevate. Now, there's a ton of great athletes down there,
no question. Absolutely.
But it's going to be hard to lure them away from something they've grown up watching.
The best way to lure them, though, is by playing a game in Australia. And the wheels are already turning on that front. Talk of official NFL match, as they say it. NFL game coming to Australia August 2024. is the date that has been thrown out there, which would mean a preseason game, presumably.
And I tell you this right now, it has to be the opening preseason game of the season because
could be
the time change is a crusher.
That doesn't help.
A crusher.
Well, if you put a preseason game there, you can play it anytime you want.
Exactly. They can play it, and then they can stay there a week before, get acclimated, have fun, do all the, you know, go to the zoo and pet a kangaroo and all that kind of stuff. Then you play the
kangaroo.
You know, they got to do all the PR moves, right? They're going to do all that. They'll surf. They'll do all the Aussie stuff.
Yep.
Then play the game, leave immediately, and come home on a 18-hour flight to get home, and then on the day that they left, before they left, right? No,
saved a day in my life.
So then you know you can get acclimated for your next preseason game, which by the way, you know is like you know days away, and you got to start training. You got to keep going to training camp. That listen, the logistics of that are exactly why it's hard.
That's why I'm not in the travel business.
Oh my gosh.
As you know, the league handed out international marketing rights to a whole bunch of teams in certain countries. There were three NFL clubs that were granted international marketing rights in Australia. One of those three teams has already expressed an interest in playing a game in Australia.
Who are they?
The LA Rams.
Really?
So look for them to be part of that August 2024. I can't remember the other two, but I believe they were both West Coast teams. I want to say Arizona, but I'm not 100% sure. And there was another Western, you know,
team. San Francisco, Arizona, something like that.
Somebody like that. Yeah, maybe Seattle. I can't remember. But the Rams have already expressed an interest. I mean, they want to play a game in Australia.
It's so far away. I don't know whether it would be better to go east or west to get there.
Well, for people on the West Coast, it's obviously west. But Pacific's a pretty damn big ocean. So
Atlantic's not so big.
Not as big,
right?
But then you still got to go through. You got to fly across Africa.
You probably go through Istanbul.
Istanbul,
Or maybe further south, down to.
Yeah, I'm thinking you're coming from the East Coast. You're swooping down below the equator to get to the narrower part of the Earth down there to fly fewer air miles, right?
Right.
You don't want to fly over the fattest part of the Earth.
That's what I'm saying. Whatever.
I would say dip down, but what do I know?
Go southeast over. You know, Bermuda and all that direction, down across over to Africa there, then bounce over to...
This geography lesson brought to you by Steve Tasker.
It is so far, Bro Sleeve. It is...
Let's just think about the ground we've covered on today's show. This is pretty impressive.
I'll tell you what, though.
And there's more.
Think about this. I might volunteer. I can say, you station me in Sydney, Australia for a couple of years for
the
NFL.
Look at you volunteering.
Just let's go. That'd be, you know.
Work for the Rams for a week, sure.
Take a hiatus. I'll do it.
Okay.
I'm in a place in my life where, I don't have, the kids don't care.
We'll send the memo to Park Avenue. We'll see how it goes.
Right?
All right? We'll keep you posted on
it. I'm on it. Go. Send me.
We take a break here. Plenty more coming your way. Who knows what's coming next here on One Bills Live, presented by Kaleida Health. It's Buffalo Bills Radio. All right, welcome back. Final half hour here on a Friday. We did get it confirmed. Steve, the Australian marketing rights. You want to
Be honest? Our colleague here at One Bills Drive, Jason Sinaraja, said there's only one team got of Australia, and that was the LA
marketing
Rams.
Rights.
Marketing rights.
And
he also said there is a New York to Sydney flight on the way. It's from New York to Sydney. Wow, that's a long one. Nonstop.
They got to have the sleeper chairs, right, for that?
Sleeper chairs.
You know, the ones that fully recline, they give you the blankets and...
Bro, that, yes, the full flat.
Yeah.
Fully flat, yes.
You have to do that.
You got to, and
you wouldn't be able to feel your tush getting off that plane if you sat that long.
You can't fly like that. Seriously, it's like a 16-hour thing.
Yeah.
More than that.
My folks did that about 10, 12 years ago. They loved it, but they're like, you got to sack out. On the flight,
and I'm you got to have a little chemical help, I would think, too. Sleeping pill, right?
I mean, I don't sleep well on planes, but I've never been on a plane.
Double martini or something to help you sleep for that one, man. Oh man, 16 hours. You got to stay up for 36 hours before you get on the plane, so you just conk out. You want to sleep so soundly that the flight attendant has to come by and say, "Sir, are you okay?
Yeah, you got to jar you awake.
as soon as you shovel her, yeah, she's like, fine, fine, let's leave. Okay. That's how soundly you need to sleep.
We neglected to mention it is the Friday fan mailbag, so the OBL Friday fan mailbag needs to be opened here today, as we have not gotten to it yet. Nick asks, is Elam a lock for CB2, or is there potential for a legitimate position battle with Dane Jackson? I believe there is a legitimate position battle with Dane Jackson. And as we know how this coaching staff operates. You got to earn it. You don't get handed anything.
Here. Everybody has to earn it, including Tre'Davious White and Taron Johnson.
Right.
All those
guys.
I know people
might say, well, hold on a second. Tre'Davious White was the 27th pick in the draft, and he started from day one. Let's remember what the roster looked like in 2017.
Right.
Okay. Tre'Davious White walks onto this team as a rookie now. He's probably in a very same boat that Kyir Elam is. He's going to be in a position battle with Dane Jackson, unquestionably.
Yeah, they're better now than they were in 2017. But every guy, they'll tell you, and that's one of the things about this team, players from the outside coming in like about what they hear here in Buffalo. I mean, you go online now and look back at the guys I mentioned earlier in the show, guys like Quentin Spain and John Feliciano, and you can go down the list of players who have been starters who couldn't keep their job. They just get outperformed, and they just get benched as a result for performance, for whatever. You got to earn it all the time. And Sean McDermott has shown Leslie Frazier, and when he was here at Brian Daboll, they have shown incredible leadership to stick by that tenet of earning it every day. If you don't earn it every day, you're sitting down. Taron Johnson got benched in 2020 during the season. Cam Lewis, and then earned it back and made the 101-yard interception return to ice the Baltimore Raven playoff game. He got benched during that season. That's what makes this team as good as it is year in and out. It's the leadership, Sean McDermott and their coordinators and the coaching staff's desire and willingness to bench a really good player if he takes his foot off the gas.
Yeah, your hold on a starting job travels the razor's edge here in
Buffalo.
That's
right. And guys respond, and believe me, as a player, I'm all about it. Yes, I'll bring it. If I need a break, I'll take a break. But the team doesn't have to suffer for that.
Yeah.
If I need, you know, whatever. If I want to play, all I got to do is show how much on the field, and I'll get my chance. And we've seen it. Duke Johnson a couple mm-hmm. years ago. Jake Kumerow from nowhere. All these guys. So, yes, Kyir Elam is in a battle for CB2,
yep.
Just like Tre'Davious White's in a battle for CB1 and Taron Johnson in a battle for his nickel corner. And that's the way it is. Yep. And that's the way I think most fans, if they know what they're talking about, they need to see it continue.
From Jack, on what appears to be a super deep roster, who's the undrafted guy or practice squad holdover who has the best chance to make the final 53? Two undrafteds to watch for me are tight end Jalen Weidermeyer and offensive lineman Alec Anderson. From practice squad last year, interested to see McLeod and Griffin. Steve and I were just talking about McLeod the other day. Corner with really good size at 6'1", played at NC State, then his final year at Notre Dame, made the practice squad here last year. For those that don't remember, he got plucked off the practice squad, was on Cincinnati's active roster, the AFC champions. And then he got clipped at the end of the season. They had some injuries at some other positions. He got clipped off the roster. The Bills scooped him back up, signed him as a reserve future free agent. So he's back on the roster here. I think he does have a chance to be one of the five corners on this roster, maybe sixth corner, if they decide to keep as many. Otherwise, he's on practice squad again. And I'm going to tell you right now, Steve, the Weidermeyer kid is somebody to watch. Played at Texas A&M, was a playmaking tight end. He ran a horrible 40 time of about 5 flat and fell off the radar because of it. And his production is at the end of his college career wasn't as good as his sophomore year. But he is an unquestionable athlete in the passing game, and I think he can make a difference. Anderson, I think, is a good pick too, Jack. Right tackle at UCLA. Did pretty well there. Could he be a fringe roster guy / practice squad guy? I got to see more of him, but he's certainly a name I would put on that list. So good picks by Jeff.
Yeah, very much so. I'll say this as well.
you talk about a guy like McLeod and Griffin. The one thing that some of these guys have, like McLeod, we talk about all the time. He's got some traits.
Yep.
He's big.
Long.
Big. And you know what? I was watching him practice. He's thick. You know, he looks
he's
heavy.
Not a wiry 6'1".
Yeah, he's not this long, lean, kind of spider monkey looking guy, man. He's put together, which lends itself to believing he's a physical type corner, which, you know, is always a plus. So, yeah, the reason you can pick these guys and have some confidence in it because they're signing guys just like they draft them. When you see them, they got something that catches your eye.
Yeah.
Size, strength, speed, skill set. So, that's a good mailbox right there.
Last one from Eric. Bonjour, OBL. Isn't the whole scouting department under-celebrated each season with all the success we've had those recent past seasons? Well, look, I think we've capably heaped praise on Brandon Bean and his personnel department the last several years with the additions they've made to this roster. And I think it goes hand in hand with what we've said about the coaching staff for years. The player development that this coaching staff produces, making players better after they get here, is phenomenal. Brandon Bean and his personnel department find talent, as Steve mentioned, with elite physical traits, and then the coaching staff hones that talent into something even better than when they got here. And we hear Coach McDermott say it all the time, Steve, we want you to come here and be the best version of yourself. And more often right. than not, the players are.
And they work hard at making it sure it happens. So you get these guys, certainly they come in with, like I said, the traits and stuff, but you get a guy like McLeod and this Elijah Griffin, Alec Anderson, Jalen Weidermeyer. The thing about them is that the longer they can hang around the building, the better they're going to get and the better chance there is that the Bills are actually going to need the guy. And all of a sudden, on a really, really good roster, one of these guys or all of them or a combination of them are good enough to get on the roster and contribute.
Yeah,
that's the way this thing works. If they can flip the switch the right way in their head, be committed enough to getting better every day, they have to believe, and they do, and sometimes it happens where the guy just elevates and elevates and elevates, and all of a sudden you can't get him off the field. Great example is Taron Johnson. You know, we didn't know who Taron Johnson was.
He's a fourth-round draft choice.
Right, he's a fourth-rounder. Okay, he's nice. Man, oh, man.
Gabriel Davis.
The guy makes plays. Gabriel Davis, another one. So it doesn't always happen that the guy elevates to a point where they do it, but man, oh, man. When you've got some physical traits and you're in this kind of culture that they've got, and you know every day that if you practice hard enough, you're productive enough, if you're doing all the right things, you will earn a chance. That's all these guys ask for.
Break time for us here. We've heard of drug policies for players in professional sports leagues. A drug policy and sanctions for fans? The English Premier League's doing it. We'll tell you why next here on One Bills Live, presented by Kaleida Health. It's Buffalo Bills Radio. All right, so Steve, we're all too familiar with drug policies for professional athletes in professional sports leagues. The English Premier League, however, has a drug policy for their fans. They have revealed new sanctions for cocaine use by fans. They could face a 5-year ban and be forced to surrender their passports when their team is playing abroad. UK policing minister Kit Malthouse said the FA, the EPL, and the English Football League have expressed support for a ban after Class A drug use was identified as a key factor in the rise in violence and disorder in the sport. UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson even weighed in with the following quote. Middle-class cokeheads should stop kidding themselves. Their habit is feeding a war on our streets, driving misery and crime across our country and beyond. How about that for a quote from the Prime Minister?
Your wrong accent, but okay. Yeah, that's an issue. Let's
800 soccer-related arrests.
Let's not bring that to our country, okay?
Yeah, let's not. Get yourselves together there, English soccer fans. You had a bad run in the 90s. Don't repeat it. We'll see you next week.